You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. So, according to the law of the land, American corporations today enjoy many of the same rights as American citizens. And as the Talking Heads song goes, how did we get here? Or maybe you'd first like to know, where did the idea of a corporation come from? For the answer to the first question, you'd be looking at one of California's own robber barons, Leland Stanford. For the answer to the second, you can look back to the Romans in 300 BC or 2,000 years later to colonial America. These answers and many more surprising aspects of U.S. history are in Adam Winkler's revelatory and timely new book, We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights, which the New York Times hailed as, quote, a masterful retrospective map at a time when people are feeling bewildered and enraged by growing corporate power. So if you want to understand landmark cases like Citizens United and Hobby Lobby and how businesses have changed the course of American politics, Adam Winkler is here today to set you on the road to more knowledge. Adam Winkler is professor of law at UCLA and an expert on constitutional law. His scholarship has been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. He's also the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, which he discussed previously at Aloud. You can hear our podcast of that on our media archive. His writing appears in many publications, including The Atlantic and The New York Times. Adam is a native Angeleno, and after law school, he clerked for David Thompson of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, practiced law in L.A., where he was on a litigation team that represented the late Michael Jackson in a highly publicized child molestation case, which was, as his bio notes, quote, more than enough to convince him to return to the ivory tower. Our interlocutor today is one of America's finest journalists, Rick Wartzman. Rick's newest book, on sale today as well, is The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America, recently nominated for an L.A. Times Book Award in nonfiction. Rick last spoke here at Aloud about his book, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. He is director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute, which is part of the Claremont Graduate University. And he worked for 2 decades as a reporter, editor, and columnist at the Wall Street Journal and the L.A. Times, where he helped shape a 3-part series on Walmart's impact on the economy and society, which won the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. Without further ado, please welcome Adam Winkler and Rick Wartzman. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. Good to see you all. Adam, great to see you.
Thank you.
I'm tempted to ask you about so much. I mean, through terrible tragedy, the Second Amendment is back in the news, and you've written a whole book on that. There's the smackdown between the Attorney General of the United States and California, and a few things unfolding in Washington that are right up your alley, captured perfectly by the Andy Borowitz piece in The New Yorker last month. I don't know if you saw it. It was headlined, Trump says he has been treated very unfairly by people who wrote Constitution. But as tempted as I am to dive into all of that with you, you've written a great new book, We the Corporations, so we'll focus there. One of the overarching themes of the book is that while the Citizens United case, I think for a lot of lay people like myself, it felt like it just came out of the blue, giving corporations constitutional rights and protections has been steadily growing over more than 100 years now. And you begin, in fact, by recounting how corporations were, in your words, bred into the very genes of American democracy and how several of the Constitution's most distinctive and significant features can be traced to America's colonial experience with the corporation. So can you talk a little bit about that early history and why it's important?
Sure. Happy to do so. And thank you, by the way, for coming and interviewing me. And thank you to Louise and the whole staff here at LA Public Library Aloud for having me, and of course for all of you for coming out. But It's true. We're bred with this myth. We learn this myth about the pilgrims who land at Plymouth Rock, and they're sort of the perfect embodiment of what America would become, right? They're fighting against tyranny. They're asserting their religious freedom. They're hardworking. It really embodies the sort of the American ideal. But before the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, the first English colony, permanent English colony in the New World, was in Jamestown. And it was established a decade and a half earlier, and it was a corporate enterprise. Jamestown was a business venture run by a company called the Virginia Company of London, which was one of the first joint stock corporations in England. And it was not here, they were not, the company came here not to assert liberty or to pursue freedom, but to pursue profit. That's what the nature of the colonial enterprise was. And then, so Jamestown was a colony, but it was also a corporation. And it had a corporate charter that dictated what people could do, what the elected officials, people who were elected by the people who invested and the investors, what they could do, the officers of the company could do. And those charters that govern the initial colonial corporations became a model for our own written constitution. You know, the framers weren't familiar with a written constitution from England. England didn't have a written constitution. They had a tradition of a variety of different documents that made their constitution. The idea of a written constitution that had clear limits on what office holders could do was in part a remnant or holdover, if you will, from the colonial corporations that first founded America.
Yeah. You talked specifically about the Massachusetts Bay Company and its body of liberties that helped, right, kind of set the pretext for the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, that's right. Often these colonial charters had not only looked a lot like the Constitution. They provided who had ordained and established this document. It set out what the office holders' rights and duties were, but also identified individual rights. So the early colonists, one of the ways they had protections in law was through these corporate charters that specified that people had a right to due process, for instance, and had rights that we don't recognize together. The Virginia Company's charter guaranteed, or the Massachusetts Bay Company charter guaranteed the right to fish. You know, it's not the right we need anymore, but nonetheless, not all the rights are the same that we have. But we still see that semblance. And some of the first elements of democracy were brought to America, again, not to pursue liberty. The Virginia Company of London set up the first representative democracy in Jamestown, where people could vote and determine their own policies to govern their own communities. But that wasn't because of some progressive ideal of democracy and freedom. It was because the Virginia Company was struggling financially and needed to get more people to come to the colonies. And so that was one of the enticements to get people to come. So even some of the important democratic reforms we have some relationship and lineage to the corporation.
And did the Founding Fathers talk about the corporation per se?
Not really. And in fact, the framers really never talked about the question of whether corporations should have rights like individuals under the Constitution. That issue never arose in the Constitutional Convention or in any of the ratifying debates, as far as we can tell. As far as we know, the framers just never even considered that one question. And in fact, it may be because they harbored a certain hostility to corporations. So, you know, if we think about things, the revolution was not just often a protest against the British government. Think about the Boston Tea Party, a very famous moment, obviously, in American history. And we're taught that the colonists were rebelling against this new British law and the tax on tea. And so they go and they throw this tea overboard to show their disrespect to the British government. But it's more complicated. It was also a protest against a powerful business corporation. What happened was, is in the early 1770s, the most powerful corporation in the world, the East India Company, that was responsible for most of the tea trade in the world, suffered a huge setback, and its profits plunged, and it threatened to bring down the financial markets of Europe. And the British government deemed the East India Company too big to fail. And passed an unprecedented bailout of the company that not only gave the company money, but gave it the right for the first time to sell tea in the colonies without going through American middlemen. And so what they were protesting was that their middlemen were being cut out of the tea trade.
And who were those middlemen?
Yeah, they were American merchants. And they went and they threw that tea overboard that night because it was tea that belonged to the East India Company.
It's wild. So as you lay it out, the first corporate rights case came in 1809. This was Bank of the United States versus DeVoe. And this was a tax dispute, but there was a bigger right constitutional issue at play here. Can you describe what that was? And also, I think this goes right to the idea of you know, the way corporations would be viewed when it comes to their personhood, right?
Yeah, no, that's great. So the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations, whether corporations had constitutional rights, was decided in 1809, so very shortly after the founding of our nation. To put that in some comparison, the first Supreme Court case to explicitly ask whether African Americans were covered by the Constitution, had constitutional rights, wasn't decided until 1857. The first Supreme Court case on whether women had rights under the Constitution wasn't decided until 1873. So corporations are pursuing individual rights and constitutional protections for as long, and in some ways longer and more successfully, than women or racial minorities. And that 1809 case is a good example. The Bank of the United States was the richest and most powerful corporation in America. The controversy over the formation of the bank is famous for giving rise to the two-party system, as Jefferson and Hamilton split up and support different sides, Jefferson hating the bank, Hamilton endorsing the bank. Also, by the way, that dispute not only gave us the two-party system, but also a really good rap battle in Hamilton the Musical, if you haven't had a chance to see that one. And a third thing it gave us was the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations. And in that case, the question was whether whether a corporation had a right under Article 3 of the Constitution that affords citizens, by word citizens, the right to sue in federal court in some circumstances. And the bank claimed to be a citizen under the Constitution. So from the very earliest days, the corporation was seeking these constitutional rights through broad interpretations of the Constitution, even when the language in the text referred to something like citizen. And that same provision, by the way, so the Supreme Court ultimately says corporations are protected by that provision. That same provision is the provision at issue 50 years later in Dred Scott, the first case on the rights of African Americans. The Supreme Court says in that case, African Americans cannot be citizens under a provision they've already held that corporations are covered and protected by. So unlike racial minorities, corporations did have rights the white man was bound to respect.
And in terms of, though, sort of recognizing them as citizens, you make this really important distinction that, again, as a layperson, I hadn't focused on before. Sort of, you know, one idea, they're citizens in and of themselves as corporate entities, or are they associations of individuals that make up their citizenship, right? Can you talk about that distinction and you know, the case in that regard?
Well, one of the interesting things I find when doing my research is that there's been a lot of debate since Citizens United about corporate personhood, about whether corporations are people and how that means, what that means in terms of their constitutional rights. But it's actually kind of a misunderstood idea. If you read Citizens United, it never says corporations are people. Nothing turns on that idea. In fact, they describe corporations quite differently. They don't say a corporation's a person. They say a corporation's an association of citizens, that people come together as an association and form this corporation. And that's traditionally been the basis upon which the Supreme Court has extended constitutional rights to corporations, not because corporations are people, although sometimes that issue has arisen, I don't want to deny that, but the logic of the cases has tended to rely on thinking about the corporation not as a person but as a pass-through, and that you have to protect the rights of the people within it. A good example, the Hobby Lobby case, Supreme Court recently held that Hobby Lobby, a chain of craft stores, was entitled to religious freedom under a federal statute, and was entitled, because of its religious freedom, an exemption from a requirement to cover birth control in employee health plans. And the Supreme Court, the way it reasoned, it said, well, Hobby Lobby needs this protection in order to protect the religious liberty rights of Hobby Lobby's owners, the Green family. So it's not that Hobby Lobby has religious beliefs. It's that the owners of Hobby Lobby have those religious beliefs, and the corporation's entitled to claim those rights on their behalf.
I found that, yeah, a really illuminating distinction that, again, as I have seen protesters with, you know, corporations are not people signs, you've you really helped explain that well.
And corporate personhood, what it really means in the law, it's a very well long-established legal principle, actually, outside of the Constitution. If you go back to 1757, the influential English commentator Blackstone wrote in his commentaries, he described corporations as quote-unquote artificial persons. And what that means is not that a corporation is just like you and me. It means that in the eyes of the law, a corporation is its own independent entity with its own rights and its own duties. And that's why, for instance, it's totally separate and apart from the shareholders. And that's why, for instance, if you slip and fall at a Starbucks, you can't sue the individual shareholders of Starbucks. You have to sue the company, the corporation, because the corporation and its shareholders are separate legal persons. When the Supreme Court has actually treated a corporation as its own separate legal person, apart with rights distinct and apart from the members, it's actually led to the court restricting and limiting the rights of corporations. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that not only has corporate personhood not played the role that people think, that when corporate personhood has been embraced by the court, it's led to the rights of corporations being more restricted.
Hmm. Interesting. So I told Louise before you got here, I said, you know, she asked me if I would moderate this, and I said, oh, I'd be delighted. And then I got your book, and I went, wow, that's really fat. And so, and thank God, it's a great read. And so it is, it's so full of colorful characters, and you really do just such a great job of just through your storytelling, making clear what's so interesting about the law, right? We were talking about this. It's an inherent drama about human conflict.
But by the way, I had the exact same reaction when I received the book the first time. I was like, oh, wow, that's a little thicker than I thought it was going to be.
But it's good.
It's a weapon, you know. And my last book was about guns. This one could be a substitute for a gun. You could hurt someone with it.
There you go. Well, it is a fast read because of these characters. And one of the richest, I think, is Daniel Webster, who you dub the corporation's lawyer. So why do you call him that?
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the kind words about how readable it is. You know, as a law professor, you're not really expecting to get reviews that talk about your book being readable and fascinating. You know, you're expecting this is going to be boring and put me to sleep. I've got some writing like that can put you to sleep, no doubt. And one of the things that I loved about writing this book was all the great characters in American history who it offers you the opportunity to take a new look at, and one of them is Daniel Webster. So Daniel Webster was one of the greatest Supreme Court advocates in the history of America. He argued over 220 Supreme Court cases in the early 1800s, between 1815 and 1852, at a time when most of these constitutional provisions were just first being interpreted. And he had an outsized influence on the shape of the Constitution. That's well known already. What's less well recognized is that his clients were almost inevitably big corporations, big businesses, and wealthy elites. He was one of the most expensive and highest paid lawyers of the day. So who could afford him? The big businesses. And many of his most important and influential cases in the Supreme Court were arguing on behalf of businesses and expanding the power and influence of businesses. Hmm. So, and one of the things it reminds us is that lawyers play an outsized role in the struggle for corporate rights. You know, people, when we think about racial minorities winning civil rights or women winning women's rights, those are stories about people who fought in the streets to gain their rights. They protested, they marched, they engaged in public advocacy, as well as Supreme Court cases. Corporations never marched in the street. They never made explicit claims for the public to get to recognize their rights. They just fought in courts of law. And this is a story about how they fought for Supreme Court rulings granting them our fundamental rights. And they've been able to do it because they've, in part because they've been able to afford, with the resources amassed with the corporate form, the best, most creative lawyers the country has to offer. Mm. And whereas many civil rights movements and equal rights movements for people have traditionally been underfunded and had to rely on volunteer lawyers, some of them legendary in their skills, like Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But corporations always had the ability from the get-go to hire the Daniel Websters of the world to argue for their rights. Hmm.
So one of his most significant cases in this regard was Dartmouth College, right, versus Woodward, which kind of settled whether corporations, right, were public or private, and therefore whether the Constitution's contract clause prohibited too much state interference, right, in their business. Can you talk about that? And I think it's also interesting, one of the things you seem to bring out is that a lot of these big corporate cases. Like, we don't necessarily think of Dartmouth College as a corporation, but they help sort of set the precedent, right, in a lot of ways.
No, that's right. I mean, so one thing to know about the corporation is that we think about the corporation today as this entity that a group of people have come together to try to pursue profit for their own self-interest. That's kind of how we think about corporations. But for much of the early history of corporations and for much of the history of corporations, they could only be formed for public purposes. And you could form a corporation and make money. I mean, part of the idea was to encourage people to invest their money so they would make money from it. But you would not be allowed to form a corporation unless you had a public purpose. And at the time, the government had to pass a special charter and give you that charter. And they wouldn't do it unless you were going to serve the public in some ways. That really fundamentally changes in the United States in a case that Daniel Webster argues in 1819, the Dartmouth College case. You don't need to get much into the facts except to know that what the court says at the end of that case is that corporations are private entities. They don't have to be organized for public purposes, and the public and the state and the government do not have the right to reorganize a corporation or to take over its assets at will. In that case, it did, like you say, it involved Dartmouth College, not a for-profit business corporation. But that precedent, nonetheless, is used by business corporations from then on to protect their rights and to fight against efforts by states to regulate them. So Dartmouth College is one of a number of cases in my book where it's not specifically about a business corporation, but about a nonprofit or an educational corporation. But nonetheless, the precedent then gets used by the business corporations for the ends of capital.
That's great. I thought probably the most mind-blowing story in the whole book was about how corporations affirmed that they were covered by the 14th Amendment, right, which was passed in 1868 after the Civil War and guarantees equal protection and due process. This has to be one of the greatest acts of deceit ever perpetrated in American history in my mind. I mean, I kept running into my wife going, you can't believe this, you know. So can you introduce us to Roscoe Conkling and tell us that story?
It's crazy. You're right. This is about a remarkable series of cases brought in the 1880s spearheaded by the Southern Pacific Railroad Company. Again, one of the most powerful corporations in America at the time. And California imposes a tax on railroad property, and the Southern Pacific Railroad wants to overturn this tax. And they assemble an all-star team of lawyers. Long before David Boies and Ted Olson got together to argue for marriage equality, the Southern Pacific Railroad hired a dream team of lawyers to fight back and to overturn California's law. And they wanted to use that 14th Amendment and say, this discriminates against us because we're corporations. It was an audacious thing, but they hired Roscoe Conkling to be their lead lawyer. And Conkling was an illustrious figure. He had been a leader of the Republican Party in Congress for decades. He had even been nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court himself. He turned down the position, becoming the last person ever to turn down a Supreme Court seat after having been confirmed. And his reason was financial. He was just making too much money as a lawyer for the railroads. And he went to the Supreme Court, and he argued in the Supreme Court that the 14th Amendment was not just written to protect newly freed slaves, but was also written to protect business corporations, too. And Conkling had incredible credibility when he made what was, by all accounts, an incredible argument. He had been, when he was a young congressman, on the drafting committee that had written the 14th Amendment.
He was the last living member of this committee, right?
And by 1882, when he was arguing for the Supreme Court, he's the last surviving member, so there's no one there to refute his story. He tells a whole story about how the amendment was written to protect business corporations. Historians have gone back, by the way, and looked at all the evidence and concluded that Roscoe Conkling, a trusted member of the bar, simply lied to the Supreme Court.
The drama, he pulls out what you describe as this musty diary that was supposedly, right, contemporaneously written during the debates over the 14th Amendment, and says, it's all in here. These are my notes.
Yeah, that never before published notes of the deliberating committee.
And then someone actually looked at the notes and...
And it turns out he was making it up.
Blowing smoke.
Blowing smoke. But, you know, the Supreme Court actually never issues a final ruling in Conkling's case. But the case, nonetheless, it
got settled, right?
Right. It gets settled for reasons that are not clear, although I suspect and make the argument in the book that there's a good chance that his fraud was uncovered, and that was part of the problem. But what happens is just a couple years later, another one of the Southern Pacific's Railroad's test cases goes to the Supreme Court, because the court, the Southern Pacific Railroad, not only hired this dream team of lawyers, they filed 60 test cases in jurisdictions around California to try to fight for their rights. And another one of these test cases makes it to the Supreme Court a couple years later. The Supreme Court in that case explicitly says we are not ruling on whether corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment. We don't need to decide that question. But the court reporter, the person who writes up the Supreme Court's opinions and publishes them in official volumes, and traditionally includes a summary of the opinion in the beginning of it, in his summary said that the court had held that corporations were persons under the 14th Amendment and had 14th Amendment rights. Totally inaccurate summary. This, a few years later, a justice on the Supreme Court who was a confidant of Leland Stanford, the head of the Southern Pacific Railroad, the colorful Stephen Field, Justice Stephen Field, he writes in an opinion a few years later, as the court held in the Southern Pacific Railroad Company case, corporations are people entitled to equal protection under the 14th Amendment, a statement he clearly knew was wrong. Because when the court had decided the Southern Pacific case, he had written his own concurring opinion saying, hey, we should be deciding this constitutional issue. I can't believe we're not deciding it. But ever since, that case was cited over and over and over again for protecting the rights of corporations. And this bizarre fact I found, Rick, is that in 1913, someone went to try and went and collected every single 14th Amendment case that had been decided by the Supreme Court since 1868, when it was ratified. So about the first 46 years or so. And he found that during that time, the Supreme Court had heard a grand total of 28 Supreme Court cases on the rights of African Americans and 312 14th Amendment cases on the rights of business corporations.
Yes. Amazing. And you pointed out that African Americans mostly lost those cases and corporations mostly won those cases.
Yeah, corporations won a lot. In fact, from 1890 to 1937 is a period in the Supreme Court's history known as the Lochner era. In the Lochner era, the court was famous for being very, very business friendly, striking down federal child labor laws, zoning laws, minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws. Meanwhile, mostly on the basis of the 14th Amendment, meanwhile, that same Supreme Court, in cases like Plessy against Ferguson, decided in the 1890s, held that blacks essentially had no rights under the amendment that were worth judicial protection.
Wow. So and built upon fraud after fraud in terms of corporate protection. So really, really amazing story. Incredible. So as I said, you know, one of the things I love is the way you kind of weave these threads of American history and legal history and business history. The thread you really pull on around the turn of the century is the emergence of these giant trusts in tobacco and oil and so on. And it's here we begin to see questions emerge about whether the Fourth Amendment, right, protecting people against unreasonable searches and seizures and criminal investigations, and the Fifth Amendment providing, right, a person can't be compelled to incriminate himself, whether those apply to corporations. So talk about what happened in that era.
For most of the history of the corporation, which goes back to ancient Rome, corporations were not deemed to be liable for a crime. They couldn't commit a crime because they were not thought to be capable of coming up with the malicious intent that criminal liability usually requires, because they're artificial persons. But this changes around the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, and corporations increasingly become criminally liable. But this presents an interesting question. If corporations can be charged with crimes, are they entitled to the rights that the Constitution provides for criminal defendants? We don't think about it so much all the time, but if you look at the Bill of Rights, it's mostly about protecting the rights of criminal defendants or people suspected of crimes or people who are convicted of crimes. And so the question necessarily arose, did corporations have those rights too? An important turning point was a case in the early 1900s arising out of Teddy Roosevelt's famous antitrust prosecutions. Remember, Roosevelt wanted to break up the trust. It turns out, as I show in my book, he was totally in the pockets of big corporations who financed his campaigns, but that's a whole other story. But he wanted to break up the big, bad trust, and he went after the tobacco trust and subpoenaed the officers of the tobacco company to testify before the grand jury. And the companies, the tobacco companies, said, you can't call our officers to testify against us. That's a violation of the right against self-incrimination. The Supreme Court actually said, no, it's not a violation of the right of self-incrimination in that case. Because the court said, and this was one of the few cases where the court really embraced that doctrine of corporate personhood. The court said, no, a corporation's a person. It's its own independent legal entity. The officers and the rights and duties of the people who work for the corporation are wholly distinct from the rights of the corporation itself. And so that was an example where the court uses corporate personhood to actually limit the rights of corporations, right, and to say they don't have the same rights as you and me.
And you draw this distinction, particularly in that earlier era, between property rights guaranteed by the Constitution and liberty rights, which might go right more to the personhood idea. But eventually, though, the liberty rights and not just property rights also begin to rise, and your book sort of makes this turn heading toward Citizens United in that way. So that movement began, as you tell it, with First Amendment protections for newspaper companies. Wow. And another slightly colorful character in Huey Long. Can you tell us about the case that became Goscinny versus American Press Company and, again, just a great colorful story?
Right. One of the interesting issues that arise in questions of whether corporations should have rights, and especially First Amendment rights, is how do we think about media corporations and newspaper corporations? Because the New York Times and CNN are corporations, and if we say corporations have no free speech rights whatsoever, how do we handle those kinds of corporations? And that issue has bedeviled the Supreme Court too. And a very notable example, as you mentioned, is a case in the 1930s. So Huey Long, if you're not familiar with him, was the iron-fisted demagogue who was the governor and then senator of Louisiana in the 1930s. And Long was Trump before Trump.
Yep.
He was a boisterous, media-savvy populist who won election on the eve of the Great Depression, promising to make Louisiana great again. and like Trump, when the newspapers came out against him, he accused them of publishing fake news. And he hit them with a tax on their advertising revenue. What Long, he called it, he said, my tax should be called a tax on lying, 2 cents per lie. I mean, come on, that's, I think Trump tweeted that this morning, I don't know. And so the newspaper companies wanted to challenge that law in court. But the law was kind of on Long's side at the time. But nonetheless, the newspaper companies did end up winning a landmark Supreme Court decision that vastly changed and grew and expanded the scope of the freedom of the press clause in the First Amendment, greatly expanded it. It's still a precedent cited to this day for broad First Amendment free press protections. But what's often overlooked in that case is the central issue in the debate of the case and in the arguments of the case is, could these corporations claim this right of freedom of the press and freedom of speech? And the Supreme Court holds in that case that they can. And indeed, it shows what highlights a surprising thing I found in writing We the Corporations is that corporations have also been innovators in constitutional law, first movers sometimes, because they have the resources and the appetite for risk to go for these novel and risky lawsuits. They've often pushed constitutional law, been boundary breakers. And so it was corporations that were behind some of the earliest and most important freedom of the press cases. And to this day, I mean, we still think about freedom of the press cases, New York Times versus Sullivan. Well, New York Times is a corporation, or the Pentagon Papers case. It's worth remembering that the super popular movie, The Post,
right,
is a movie about a business corporation asserting its First Amendment rights.
Yeah, that's great. And in a very Trump-like way, too, the named plaintiff in the American Press case was Huey Long's mistress, who was the tax right administrator for the state. So,
that's right. her name was Alice Grostian. She was 24 years old, and she was named Secretary of State of Louisiana. She was the only woman in the entire country to hold a position of that high appointed office in the country. Unfortunately, on International Women's Day, it's not a good story for women.
No.
This is a story about, you know, he was a married man and this was his mistress. Yes. And it was part of the reason why he lost this case. I said the law was really on Long's side at the time. It really was, but part of the story was he had terrible lawyers because he had filled up his legal team with his cronies, including his attorney general who led the charge, who had been disbarred the year before. Huey Long didn't like the fact that his attorney general got disbarred, so he ordered the legislator to create a new bar and appointed the attorney general to be the head of the new bar.
Wow. The echoes go on and on.
And he ended up getting,
fascinating. So as I said, you call Daniel Webster the corporation's lawyer. You call Lewis Powell the corporation's justice. So why is that?
So, well, Lewis Powell is a really interesting figure, not a Supreme Court justice that a lot of people know necessarily, but he was appointed by Richard Nixon in 1971 and was on the court for about 15, 16 years. But 3 months before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, he wrote a memorandum for the Chamber of Commerce. It was the era of Nader and consumer rights movement and the Clean Air Act and environmental protections. Powell wrote in this memo that it was time for corporate America to fight back, that we needed to that corporate America and corporate interests needed to fight to defend capitalism, to fight against the socialists, to fight against the hippies and the leftists and the universities. And this memorandum, it's not known, it's not publicized before he gets onto the Supreme Court, but in the years afterwards becomes a very, very famous and influential planning document for the rise of the new right that ultimately leads to the election of Ronald Reagan as the president in 1980.
And the formation of Cato and Heritage, right?
All the think tanks, all the money going into corporate politics and to protecting the free enterprise system. A lot of that is really inspired and directed by this Powell memorandum. And so not only is he arguing this memorandum for corporations to become more politically active, something that inspires executives all over the country to become more politically active, but then when he's a justice on the Supreme Court, he gets the opportunity to operationalize his own recommendations. And a big case comes before him in the 1970s addressing whether corporations have the right to spend money on ballot measure campaigns. And 30 years before Citizens United, Lewis Powell writes an opinion for the Supreme Court saying that corporations have a right to be involved in politics and make political expenditures, at least on ballot measure campaigns. And it really enhances the power of big business. And even today, we know that ballot measure campaigns, that well over 70% of the financing for ballot measures comes from big business and chambers of commerce and business organizations.
And even though that was about ballot measures and not about, general elections, it sort of sets a pretext for Citizens United. And it's interesting because Ralph Nader, you mentioned, the consumer advocate who the Powell Memorandum identified as the single most effective antagonist of American business, right? Didn't he weirdly end up helping that decision go in favor of corporations, the ballot measure?
Yeah, indeed. The Powell Memorandum was inspired by a desire to fight Ralph Nader, who was literally the king of the consumer rights movement. He was on the cover of Time magazine and Newsweek, both in 1971. I mean, he was a very, very popular figure at the time. And interestingly enough, Ralph Nader gave us, in some ways, Citizens United. Ralph Nader in the 1970s brought a case to the Supreme Court arguing on behalf of consumers and articulated a theory of the First Amendment that's known as the listener's rights theory of the First Amendment, which is the idea is that it doesn't matter who the speaker is. If the speech itself has value to the listeners, in Nader's case, consumers of information, then it's constitutionally protected. And Nader's interest was only in protecting consumers and their ability to get information. And yet that precedent gets used by corporations ever since to strike down numerous laws regulating businesses.
Advertising
laws and restrictions. And is very explicitly used in the Citizens United case, where one of the things the court really relies on is the idea that the identity of the speaker is irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether it's a corporation. All that matters is whether the speech is valuable to the listeners. And they cite Ralph Nader's case for establishing that principle.
Unintended consequences, for sure. So this is my last question. I've got plenty more, and we could probably talk all afternoon. Maybe we'll over a beer later. But I'm going to open up to all of you in a minute. So we really are. I mean, this is a perfect setup to Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. So just remind us quickly just what that case was actually about, if you would. And then I'd love for you just for a minute to focus on the two different strategies that emerged among the lawyers for Citizens United of how the case, what the central argument should be, Jim Bopp's kind of orientation versus Ted Olson's, the fighter and the fixer, as you describe them, and why that became so important.
Well, I look at Citizens United. So Citizens United ultimately holds that corporations have the same free speech right as individuals to spend money on election ads. Not just corporations, unions too, although definitely it's become more associated with the union side of the equation.
The corporate side
of the equation. But said corporations have that same right to spend money as individuals. While that case was working its way up through the Supreme Court, Citizens United had two different lawyers. They had one lawyer originally, and then they hired a new lawyer later. The first lawyer is a fellow by the name of Jim Bopp, and Jim Bopp was a true believer. Jim Bopp was a warrior against campaign finance law. He's kind of a I use him as sort of an embodiment of the Tea Party. He was a guy who was a fighter. He was a guy who wanted to change the law and change it quickly, and was pretty successful. He's been really the leader of the charge against campaign finance law in the Supreme Court over the last 15 years. Very successful. But he's ultimately pushed off the case in favor of Ted Olson, who is in many ways sort of the other end of the Republican Party, not the Tea Party fighter, but the inside Washington
button down,
gets along with Democrats, whereas Bopp always refers to Obama as a socialist. Ted Olson would have Obama at his house in a minute for dinner. And Ted Olson's approach is to let's just win this case by very narrow. We don't need to have any broad precedent-setting ways of deciding this case, and we should just try to win this case on very narrow grounds. He's ultimately foiled in that effort by Justice Sam Alito and Justice Kennedy, who really pushed the court to go for a broad ruling along the lines of what Jim Bopp had originally sought, declaring that all these restrictions on corporate spending and election were unconstitutional.
That's great. So we have about 15 minutes left, so let's open it up to all of you. I'm sure you have questions for Adam as well. So great. I think mics are coming around. So
question?
Okay.
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
So Clarence Thomas seems to be the one member of the Supreme Court who is willing to go back and pull the thread out of the constitutional fabric if he thinks it shouldn't have been there in the first place, woven in the first place. So when we look at what happened with Conkling's falsity and how that gets woven in, has there been any inclination on the court to pull that thread out? And if so, who's sort of suggested that?
Right. No, it's a great question. Certainly there's no one on the court today who's willing to pull that thread out. But there was a moment where it looked like the thread might get pulled. And it was back in the late 1930s. And Justice Hugo Black was appointed to the Supreme Court, one of FDR's nominees. And Black makes a very, very bold argument. Black had never been a judge before. He was a senator. He was appointed to the Supreme Court, something we don't really see these days anymore, someone having no judicial experience really whatsoever. And Black is on the court only 3 months after he joins the Supreme Court. He writes a dissenting opinion calling for this entire line of 14th Amendment cases to be overturned, that corporations have no rights under the 14th Amendment. We need to overturn this whole line of cases. And it was a pretty audacious position for such a new justice to take. We've had, these days people are often talking about Neil Gorsuch as being very aggressive since he's joined the court. He's not the first person, and Black, even before him, was an aggressive first justice to take on some big issues. But he really never really caught on, and I think there's probably good reason why it would never catch on, because it's not really about just pulling out that thread and then all of a sudden corporate rights all just sort of fall by the wayside. I think there are really valid reasons why the Supreme Court over the years leaned in favor of corporate rights in some instances. And I think the court was really kind of onto something back in the day when it said there's a difference between property rights and liberty rights. We didn't get to talk about it much, but for a while the Supreme Court said corporations had property rights, so the government can't come in and take their buildings or factories without paying just compensation. And you can't charge a company with a crime and impose a $1 million fine on it without giving it due process of law, right? So there are those basic protections that they should have. But the Supreme Court for a long time said corporations don't have liberty rights. They don't have the rights that are associated with personal conscience or bodily integrity or political freedom. And indeed, 100 years before Citizens United, the federal courts universally upheld campaign finance restrictions right. on corporations, saying that the right to influence elections belong to natural persons, not artificial persons. It's a lesson we seem to have forgotten, and it doesn't seem like anyone on the court today is really interested in reconsidering it.
Yeah.
Does your book include your personal perspective on how the law should change from here on out? Or where how the situation could be improved or corrected? Or
right. So I have some hints in there, but my book is a work of history. It's an effort to explain how we got here. And I did have my original last chapter had a much more normative framework. This is how we should think about it going forward. My editor hated it. He's like, get that junk out of there. He's like, this is a work of history. Keep it as a work of history. But I think there are hints in there. So I have an ending conclusion where I make some suggestions. And I think the answer really is counterintuitively to start with corporate personhood. Like everyone thinks corporate personhood is the basis of getting everything wrong with corporate rights, and I think it's the basis for getting everything right. So here's what I'd say. Instead of thinking about the corporation as a pass-through, instead of thinking about Exxon as an association of citizens, we should recognize that corporation, as corporate law mandates, is its own independent entity in the eyes of the law with its own rights and its own duties. Now, just to say that corporations have rights doesn't mean they have all the rights. Minors are people under the Constitution. They don't have all the rights as you and me. Foreign nationals who reside here are people under the Constitution. They don't have all the same rights as you and me. I think we could think about corporations the same way, that they should have some rights under the Constitution, but not all the same rights as you and me. And which rights should they have? I think at least a good place to start, it's not the ending point for all questions that arise, but a good place to start is that line the Supreme Court drew 100 years ago between property rights and liberty rights. I think it's absolutely clear that corporations need to have property protections. Next time the FBI wants Apple to open up an iPhone, if Apple has no constitutional rights, it cannot stop that practice, right? It has to turn over the material to the federal government. It wouldn't have any basis for fighting it. It only has a right of due. It only fights against it because there's a right of due process of law. So I think that basic old distinction: you can protect your property rights. You have rights of due process, thought to be associated with property rights, but liberty rights we should be much more skeptical of granting corporations liberty rights like religious freedom or the right to participate in electoral politics.
I'm wondering how much of what you're discussing looks at the rights of corporations and how much of it comes from the growth of money is a form of speech and that they're in the law.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, the idea that, you know, is money speech? I mean, obviously money is not speech, right? That's not true. But it's a complicated question because money isn't abortion either. But if the government passed a law that said you can spend absolutely no money to secure an abortion, we would recognize that's a restriction on women's right to choose abortion. It's not to say that money is abortion, but that money is an important mechanism by which you that you need to get the abortion. And I think it's the same kind of the way the court sort of thinks about free speech is in those terms. It's not that money is speech, is that they recognize, right, in at least at the basic intuitive level, right, that if you prohibit people from spending money, you prohibit people from financing election ads and speech. I think part of the problem is that what the court has said is that we can't have restrictions on the amount of money individuals or corporations can spend on independent advertisements. And this has led to a huge influx of money in the political process from corporations, from unions, from wealthy individuals. And it really is a major problem. And it's I think there are good solutions to such a problem. I think a good constitutional amendment that would allow Congress to enact reasonable campaign finance laws would be a good measure. But that seems a ways away, too.
Used about how they're a collective of citizens, and yet the owners have individual rights, such as religious restrictions and such.
Such a great question, right? So the Hobby Lobby is a perfect example. So in the Hobby Lobby case, the owners, the Green family, they're the ones, their religious beliefs that are offended by the requirement to include birth control in employee health plans. And so they're imposing their beliefs on the corporation, saying the corporation, if you enforce the corporation to do something, you're essentially forcing me to do it. But again, under corporate law, there's a separation between Hobby Lobby and the underlying owners. And you can be sure that Hobby Lobby's owners would insist that they are a totally separate legal person from the corporation if someone were to slip and fall in a Hobby Lobby store today. Right? Then the divide is as clear as day and never can be breached. And I think that some people have raised that objection, that part of the problem with some of these liberty rights claims, where corporations can claim religious freedom, for instance, does seem to go counter to that idea that people are taking, people have limited liability because of that separation between the corporation and the owners. And Hobby Lobby is mixing that up rather than enforcing the separation.
Thank you. Adam, I think I heard you mention the phrase corporate responsibilities as well as liberties, and I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about responsibilities, and also in the sense that, say, like corporations like Google are using their capital comes from something that's collectively sourced, so it's from the social entity. So does that kind of cast their responsibility in a different light because we're contributing to their, in a sense, you know, what they're making their money off of?
Right. One of the things that we need to recognize is that in so many ways, we all finance these corporations to do these things that we don't like them to do. We invest in them through pension funds. Often, we don't even know what corporations were invested in pension funds. It's often hard for us as individual investors to really, because we don't even know which companies we're invested in, to really have an influence on those companies. We are seeing, it seems to me, a real growing a move for what you might think of corporate social responsibility, or maybe in this case, maybe think about corporate political mobilization. Sometimes for ends that progressives really love. So, for instance, this past week it's been celebrating Delta for disassociating itself from the NRA. And in the last couple years, we've seen corporations be celebrated for taking a strong stand against states like North Carolina that wanted to adopt anti-transgender bathroom bills. And so we've seen corporations in some ways take the lead on some of these issues. I'm always a little skeptical of that. I think, but the story that I tell in my book is one of warning, that when corporations gain these powers and these authorities to become, for instance, a bigger player in American politics, sometimes they're going to use that for ends that you like. But by and large, they're doing it to protect their brands, to make profit, to pursue profit. And it's the same political power of business that is arguing against the NRA today that a few months ago was getting a huge tax break in the tax bill because they were exercising their political power there too. So we should always be, we want corporations to be socially responsible, but we have to recognize that it brings that pursuit of profit into the world of social responsibility too.
I want you on the Supreme Court. But since that's not going to happen very soon, my question is, what do you see for the future of the Supreme Court? I am truly in fear for our democracy.
I can understand that. If you really want to be fearful of your democracy, put me on the Supreme Court.
You made too much as a UCLA law professor. You turned that down, right?
Exactly. So.
Yeah.
It was interesting. When last election, I was a Hillary voter, but I had some trepidation because if Merrick Garland had gotten on the Supreme Court, he would have almost certainly been a fifth vote to overturn Citizens United. And what would a guy who's got a book coming out about Citizens United do if they overturned it? So I was a little mixed on that. I had torn loyalties, I guess.
It's always about profit.
Well, yeah, I don't make any profit on the book, that's for sure. I will say this, though. I do think that it seems very possible that President Trump will get another appointment to the Supreme Court at some point. Maybe, maybe not. We just don't know for sure. A lot of the justices are nearing retirement age, if not 10 years past retirement age. So it could happen, and I think that every appointment he gets really makes it much harder to reform the corrections that the conservative judicial activism will provide. And but tie it into a larger historical trend, because this is not just about Trump, and it's not just about this particular moment, I think, actually. The story that I tell in my book is that corporations have really been pursuing this power in the courts for a long, long time, and that we think of the Supreme Court as a bulwark to protect minority rights. But over the course of American history, it really hasn't done that often. But it has broadly and aggressively read the Constitution over and over again to protect business corporations. And something that unites justices over the course of American history, we think of justices being Republican appointees or Democratic appointees, liberals or conservative, originalists or living constitutionalists. But the truth is, you go back through American history, what unites the vast majority of our justices from either side of the political spectrum is that they rule in favor of business. And that's the case with the current Supreme Court, too. So I think the interests of business are going to continue to be secure and protected in the Supreme Court. Yeah, of course.
We're going to do one more, and then I think we have to call it a day here. So
I have a question about the privatization of the legal system, and specifically it's occasioned by very recent events. I wondered if a private mediation service, which in this case is, in the Stormy Daniels case, is alternative dispute resolution, do they have a power to issue a restraining order? And my understanding is the restraining order included keeping the fact of the arbitration private, and what you thought about that.
Yeah.
What are the roles of the court with the private alternative dispute resolution system?
So I can't really speak to the facts of this particular mediation and whatnot. I just haven't followed it closely enough to really be able to speak with any knowledge to that. But I will say that the larger question of privatization of justice is definitely a theme in the book. Not so much in the formal ways that we're going to privatize, say, prosecutors by farming that out to private entities or private prisons the way we've done so, but the way in which even our most fundamental rights, which we think of as our sort of public heritage, right, the heritage of we the people, how the corporations have aggressively used the courts to take over those rights. And we think about corporate power often in America in terms of corporate influence over the elected branches, or in campaign finance or in lobbying. That's where we generally think about corporate power. But I think the story is also fundamentally how corporations have used the judiciary to enhance and affirm up their power, and that the judiciary is not this institution that, because Lady Justice wears a blindfold, is really blind, and that she has the scales, that it's really equal. Corporations have always been advantaged in the in our judicial process because they've always had the money and the resources and the appetite
and
for
the connections,
risk,
right?
And the connections, yeah. And ideological colleagues in the robes too.
Yeah.
And so the story is really a story about corporate power in the courts.
Great. Well, we got our Stormy Daniels question in, so we're good. So thank you all for being here and joining us.
And thanks
to Adam. Thanks for writing a great book.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17